Chapter 5. The Quantum World. In 1799, Joseph Banks, president of the august Royal Society of London, founded a new establishment, the Royal Institution of Great Britain, with the aim of introducing useful mechanical inventions and improvements and teaching the general public courses of philosophical lectures and experiments. Ever since then, the RI, as it is commonly known today, has continued to put on public lectures and events, including its Friday evening discourses, public lectures delivered in its Faraday Lecture Theatre, which have been an integral part of its programme since they were set up by Michael Faraday himself in 1826. I've had the honour of giving two of these, the last one in 2013, when I talked about the subject of this chapter, quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics is seen, quite rightly, as the most fascinating, yet at the same time most mind-boggling and frustrating scientific theory ever devised by humankind. In a particular segment of my lecture at the RI, I discuss the famous two-slit experiment, which describes what the American physicist Richard Feynman called the central mystery of quantum mechanics. After outlining just how astonishing the results of the two-slit experiment are, subatomic particles fired one by one through a screen with two narrow slits in it, behaving as though they each travelled through both slits at once and giving rise to an interference pattern on a second screen, I issued a challenge to my audience. If anyone were able to come up with a common sense account of how this is possible, they should get in touch with me, as they will no doubt be up for a Nobel Prize. I said this as a light-hearted joke, safe in the knowledge that no one has ever found a simple explanation of this classic result, despite many decades of debate and hundreds of ingenious tests, leading physicists to reluctantly conclude that whatever is going on really does not have a common sense explanation. This really is the way matter behaves in the quantum world, and we just have to accept it. I also assumed, when I cast down the proverbial gauntlet, that I was addressing just the few hundred members of the RI audience that Friday evening. But the RI posts much of its educational material online, which included my lecture. And since then, I've received hundreds of emails from amateur scientists claiming to have solved this central quantum mystery and suggesting that maybe physicists have forgotten to consider this or that mechanism or detail. I used to respond, but I confess that I don't anymore. So let me make amends for my lack of correspondence with those folk who continue to puzzle over the mysteries of quantum mechanics and describe some of its most important and non-intuitive features. In this chapter, we'll take a brief look at what this second pillar of modern physics tells us about the microcosm. Having devoted my own research career, now careering into its fourth decade, to its study and application, first in nuclear physics and more recently in molecular biology, you won't be surprised to hear that I regard quantum mechanics as the most powerful and important theory in all of science. After all, it's the foundation on which much of physics and chemistry is built, and it has revolutionized our understanding of how the world is built from the tiniest of building blocks. A quantum mechanics primer. The status of physics towards the end of the 19th century appeared to be complete. It had produced Newtonian mechanics, electromagnetism, and thermodynamics, which I'll talk about in Chapter 6, and showed that together these three areas of physics successfully described the motion and behavior of all everyday-sized objects and pretty much all phenomena we encounter around us, from cannonballs to clocks, storms to steam trains, magnets to motors, and pendulums to planets. Collectively, the study of all these things is referred to as classical physics, and it's still predominantly what we are taught at school. However, classical physics, while still pretty good, is not the whole story. When physicists turn their attention to the microscopic constituents of matter, atoms and molecules, they discovered new phenomena they couldn't explain with the physics they knew. It seemed that the laws and equations they were using no longer applied. Physics was about to undergo a seismic paradigm shift. The first major theoretical breakthrough, the concept of the quantum, was made by the German physicist Max Planck. In a lecture in December in 1900, he proposed the revolutionary idea that the heat energy radiated by a warm body is linked to the frequency at which its atoms vibrated, and consequently that this radiated heat is lumpy rather than continuous, emitted as discrete packets of energy, which became known as quanta. Within a few years, Einstein had proposed that it wasn't just Planck's radiation that was emitted in lumps, but that all electromagnetic radiation, including light, came in discrete quanta. We now refer to a single quantum of light, a particle of light energy, as a photon. Einstein's proposal that light is quantum in nature was more than just a hunch. It explained one of the biggest outstanding scientific mysteries of the time, called the photoelectric effect, a phenomenon in which light, when shone on a metal surface, can knock electrons out of the metal's atoms. This effect could not be explained if light were a wave, because if so, then increasing the intensity, the brightness, of the light would mean increasing its energy, and we would expect the electrons knocked out from the metal to fly off faster. But they don't. There are just more of them. But if the energy of the light is proportional to its frequency rather than its intensity, as Einstein proposed, then increasing its frequency, for example from visible to ultraviolet, would cause the electrons to be knocked out with more energy. And conversely, keeping the frequency or colour of the light the same, but increasing its brightness, would just mean that more photons would be produced and more electrons knocked out. This is exactly what is seen in experiments, and Einstein's explanation fitted beautifully. And yet there was, and still is, plenty of contrary evidence suggesting that light is made up of waves rather than a stream of particles. So, which is it? Is light a wave or a particle? The answer, frustratingly, flying in the face of intuition and common sense, is that it can behave like either, depending on how we look at it and the sort of experiment we devise to probe it. And it's not just light that has this schizophrenic nature. Particles of matter, such as electrons, can exhibit wave-like nature too. This general notion, tested and confirmed for almost a century now, is known as wave-particle duality and is one of the central ideas of quantum mechanics. This doesn't mean that an electron is both a particle and a wave at the same time, but rather that if we set up an experiment to test the particle-like nature of electrons, we find that they do indeed behave like particles. But if we then set up another experiment to test if electrons have wave-like properties, such as diffraction or refraction or wave interference, we see them behaving like waves. It's just that we cannot carry out an experiment that would show both the wave and particle nature of electrons at the same time. It is absolutely vital to stress here that while quantum mechanics correctly predicts the outcomes of such experiments, what it does not tell us is what an electron is, only what we see when we carry out certain experiments to probe it. The only reason this no longer drives physicists crazy with exasperation is that we've learnt to accept it. This balance between how much we can simultaneously know about an electron's particle nature, its position in space, and its wave nature, how fast it's travelling, is governed by Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, which is regarded as one of the most important ideas in the whole of science and a foundation stone of quantum mechanics. The uncertainty principle puts a limit on what we can measure and observe. But many people, even physicists, are prone to misunderstanding what this means. Despite what you will find in physics textbooks, the formalism of quantum mechanics does not state that an electron cannot have a definite position and a definite speed at the same time, only that we cannot know both quantities at the same time. A related common misunderstanding is that humans must play some kind of crucial role in quantum mechanics, that our consciousness can influence the quantum world, or even bring it into existence when we measure it. This is nonsense. Our universe, all the way down to its elementary building blocks at the quantum scale, existed long before life began on Earth. It wasn't sitting in some fuzzy limbo state waiting for us to come along, measure it, and make it real. By the mid-1920s, physicists were beginning to realize that the concept of quantization is more general than just the lumpiness of light or the waviness of matter. Many physical properties familiar to us as continuous are in fact discrete, digital rather than analog, once you zoom down to the subatomic scale. For example, the electrons bound within atoms are quantized in the sense that they can only have certain specific energies and never energies in between these discrete values. Without this property, electrons would continuously leak energy while orbiting the nucleus, meaning that atoms would not be stable and complex matter, including life, could not exist. The term orbit here is in fact wrong, since atoms are not miniature solar systems and electrons are not localized particles like tiny planets going around the sun. According to 19th century pre-quantum electromagnetic theory, negatively charged electrons should spiral inwards towards the atom's positively charged nucleus. But their quantized energy states prevents this from happening. Certain quantum rules also define which energy states the electrons occupy and how they arrange themselves within atoms. As such, the rules of quantum mechanics dictate how atoms combine together to make molecules, making quantum mechanics the foundation of the whole of chemistry. Electrons are able to jump between energy states by emitting or absorbing the correct amount of energy. They can drop to a lower state by emitting a quantum of electromagnetic energy, a photon, of exactly the same value as the difference in energies between the two states involved. Likewise, they can jump to a higher state by absorbing a photon of the appropriate energy. The submicroscopic world, down at the scale of atoms and smaller, therefore behaves very differently from our familiar everyday world. When we describe the dynamics of something like a pendulum or tennis ball or a bicycle or a planet, we're dealing with systems comprising many trillions of atoms, which are far removed from the fuzziness of the quantum realm. This allows us to study the way these objects behave using classical mechanics and Newton's equations of motion, the solutions of which are an object's precise location, energy, or state of motion, all knowable simultaneously at any given moment in time. But if we wish to study matter on the quantum scale, we must forego the mechanics of Newton and use the very different mathematics of quantum mechanics. Typically, we would solve Schrödinger's equation to calculate a quantity called the wave function, which describes not the way an individual particle moves along a definite path, but the way its quantum state evolves in time. The wave function can describe the state of a single particle or a group of particles, and has a value that provides us with the probability of, say, finding an electron with any given set of properties or a location in space, if we were to measure that property. The fact that the wave function has a value at more than one point in space is often wrongly taken to mean that the electron itself is physically smeared out across space when we're not measuring it. But quantum mechanics does not tell us what the electron is doing when we're not looking, only what we should expect to see when we do look. If you're not reassured by this statement, you are not alone. It's not meant to reassure you, or to discourage you for that matter. It is simply stating what all physicists agree on when it comes to the meaning of quantum mechanics. Beyond this, there's a whole host of different ways of explaining the nature of the quantum world. These are known as the interpretations of quantum mechanics, and the arguments between advocates of these different views have raged for as long as quantum mechanics has been around, and show no sign of abating. What does it all mean? Despite its tremendous success, if we dig a little deeper into what quantum mechanics tells us about the microcosm, we could easily lose our minds. We ask ourselves, but how can it be so? What am I not getting? The truth is, no one really knows for sure. We don't even know if there is any more to get. Physicists have tended to use terms like strange, weird, or counterintuitive to describe the quantum world. For despite the theory being powerfully accurate and mathematically logical, its numbers, symbols, and predictive power are a facade, hiding a reality we find difficult to reconcile with our mundane, common-sense view of the everyday world. There is, however, a way out of this predicament. Since quantum mechanics describes the subatomic world so remarkably well, and since it's built on such a complete and powerful mathematical framework, it turns out we can manage just fine by learning how to use its rules in order to make predictions about the world and to harness it to develop technologies that rely on those rules, leaving the hand-wringing and head-shaking to the philosophers. After all, the laptop on which I typed this book would not exist were it not for the developments of quantum mechanics that allowed us to create modern electronics. But if we take this pragmatic attitude, we must accept that we become no more than quantum mechanics ourselves, practitioners and technicians who do not care how or why the quantum world behaves the way it does, but who simply accept it and move on. Every fiber of my being tells me that this should not be enough for a physicist. Is it not the job of physics to describe the world? Quantum mechanics, without an interpretation of its equations and symbols, is just a mathematical framework that allows us to calculate and predict the results of experiments. That should not be enough. Physics should be about explaining what our results tell us about how the world really is. The fact that many physicists will not agree with this statement is a failing that can be traced back to one of the greatest thinkers in the history of science, the father of quantum mechanics, Niels Bohr. So influential was he that even as I say this, I feel a sense of guilt, that I'm betraying one of my great heroes. And yet I must stand true to my convictions. Without doubt, Bohr's philosophical views have shaped the way generations of physicists think about quantum mechanics. But they have also, in the eyes of an increasing number, discouraged and stifled progress. Bohr argued that it is wrong to think that the task of physics is to find out how nature is, or to know the real essence of the phenomena, but rather to concern itself only with what we can say about nature, the aspects of our experience. These two opposing views, the first ontological and the second epistemological, can in fact both be correct. What a physicist should be able to say about nature, even at the quantum scale, should be the same as how nature is, or as close to it as we can get, but always trying to edge closer. This realist view is one that I have always found myself siding with in the end, despite having serious doubts now and again. On the other end of the scale, there's a danger lurking in the shadows should we overstress the weirdness of quantum mechanics rather than focusing on its power and success as a scientific theory. For doing so attracts the attention of charlatans, just as a bright light attracts moths. The undeniably inexplicable predictions of quantum mechanics, such as entanglement or separated particles being instantaneously linked across space, have over the years provided fertile ground for all manner of pseudoscientific nonsense, from telepathy to homeopathy. Generations of physicists have been trained to follow Bohr's pragmatic dogma, known as the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, in part to avoid the sort of philosophical musings that can spill over into New Age baloney. Incidentally, the Copenhagen interpretation is named after the city of Bohr's famous Institute for Theoretical Physics, where so much of the earlier mathematical foundations of the theory were laid out in the mid-1920s. Like all physics students for generations, I was taught quantum mechanics by first being introduced to its historical origins and the work of Planck, Einstein, Bohr, and others. But my education quickly moved on to the mathematical techniques, the toolkit that I needed to make use of the theory. And along with the maths, I learnt a pile of concepts named after the theory's founding fathers. Born's rule, Schrödinger's equation, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, Pauli's exclusion principle, Dirac notation, Feynman diagrams, the list goes on. But while all of this is important to know if we're to make sense of the quantum world, what I was not taught were the arguments and philosophical debates that took place between all these great physicists, which lasted throughout their lives and which, to a large extent, remain unresolved. Much of the interpretational difficulty with quantum mechanics revolves around the so-called measurement problem. How does the ephemeral quantum world come into sharp focus when we carry out a measurement? Where's the boundary between the quantum and the classical worlds? Between things that do not have well-defined properties when left to their own devices, and the reassuring solidity of what we measure and see. Many of the founding fathers, men such as Niels Bohr, Werner Heisenberg, and Wolfgang Pauli, believed it was pointless to worry about such matters and advocated following the Copenhagen philosophy I described earlier. They were happy to split the world in two, quantum behavior and classical behavior, without tying down how one transitioned into the other upon measurement. To them, quantum mechanics worked, and that was enough. But this positivist attitude can hinder the advance of science. While it may help lead us to a better understanding of some phenomena and even to developing new technologies, it doesn't help us to truly understand. Of course, my Copenhagenist colleagues would vehemently disagree with me here. They would argue that they do understand all there is to be understood about what quantum mechanics can and cannot tell us, and that it is the realists who refuse to accept or understand this. The history of science is littered with examples of this sort of attitude. One of the most obvious comes from ancient cosmology. For two millennia, from antiquity until the birth of modern science, there was an almost universal hegemony and acceptance of the geocentric model of the universe, that the Earth is at the center of the cosmos and that the Sun, along with all the planets and stars, orbits around us. A positivist back then would have argued that since this model works so well in predicting the motion of heavenly bodies, it was unnecessary to look for alternative explanations for how or why they moved across the sky in the way we see. Indeed, there was a time when the geocentric model was more accurate at matching astronomical observations than the correct and much simpler Copernican heliocentric model. But interpreting a theory in a particular way just because it works is intellectual laziness, and certainly not in the true spirit of what physics should be about. The same should be true of quantum mechanics. The renowned quantum physicist John Bell once famously said that the aim of physics is to understand the world, and to restrict quantum mechanics to be exclusively about piddling laboratory operations is to betray the great enterprise. Sadly, too many physicists, even today, do not grasp this. Yet another argument for why philosophy is not just pointless navel-gazing, but can contribute to the advancement of science. If you were to conduct a poll among quantum physicists, at least those who care about such matters, you would find that a significant, though decreasing, fraction will still adopt the pragmatic Copenhagen view. But a growing number see it as an abdication of the role of physics, and instead subscribe to one of a number of alternative interpretations. A list that includes such exotic-sounding ideas as the many-worlds interpretation, the hidden variables interpretation, the dynamical collapse interpretation, the consistent histories interpretation, and the relational interpretation, and I've left out a number of others. No one knows which, if any, of these different ways of describing reality at the quantum scale is the correct one. They all work. They all make, so far, the same predictions of the results of experiments and observations, and all emerge from the same mathematics. Although some realist interpretations, such as spontaneous collapse models, do make predictions that others don't, and so are in principle testable. Sometimes advocates of these different interpretations can defend them dogmatically, treating their favourite version almost like religions, which is not how science is going to progress. And yet, slow progress is being made in trying to understand the quantum world. Experimental techniques are becoming ever more subtle, and certain explanations are being ruled out. The hope is that one day we will indeed find out how nature really does perform her quantum trickery. If this sounds sensible to you, there are plenty of physicists who will disagree. The positivists argue that science is nothing more than a tool for predicting the outcome of experiments, and that those who worry about what quantum mechanics tells us about reality by reading more than they should into its mathematics are indeed better suited for doing philosophy instead. In fairness, not all advocates of this positivist Copenhagenist view of reality have been dismissive of attempts to dig deeper. In the early 2000s, a new anti-realist interpretation called quantum Bayesianism, or cubism, appeared, whose proponents see reality as being entirely subjective and down to personal experience. Critics have even likened it to solipsism. Choosing an interpretation of quantum mechanics should be more than just a matter of philosophical taste. The fact that they all make the same predictions about the world does not mean that all these interpretations are equivalent, or that we are free to choose the one we like the best on a whim. Explaining some aspect of reality through physics is a two-step process. First, we find the mathematical theory, which of course may or may not be correct. But if we believe it is right, like Einstein's field equations of general relativity, or Schrödinger's equation in quantum mechanics, then we next need ways of interpreting or explaining what the mathematics means. These are the stories we attach to the maths. Without them, we cannot connect our symbols and equations, however aesthetically pleasing we find them, to the physical universe we observe. And we need to find the right story just as much as the right mathematical theory. The different interpretations of quantum mechanics paint very different pictures of reality. Either there are parallel universes, the many worlds interpretation, or there are not. Either there is a physical, non-local quantum field, the pilot wave hidden variables interpretation, or there isn't. Nature doesn't care about our petty squabbles regarding the correct interpretation of quantum mechanics. It gets on with doing things the way it does, and exists independently of our perceptions. If we have a problem with agreeing on how the quantum world behaves, then that is our problem. Einstein believed this. He was a realist too. He believed that physics should be about describing how the world really is. And if there is more than one description that fits the mathematics of quantum mechanics, then we should not be satisfied. I feel I'm in good company in this regard. Entanglement, measurement, and decoherence. That said, even Einstein could get things wrong on occasion. One of the most profound and inexplicable predictions of quantum mechanics is the idea of entanglement. In the quantum world, two or more particles can be linked across space instantaneously in a way that almost defies logic. Technically, this is known as non-locality, and it can be encapsulated in the idea that what happens over here can instantaneously affect and be affected by what happens over there. We say that the two particles are described by the same quantum state, the same wave function. Einstein always felt uncomfortable about non-locality and entanglement, deriding it as spooky action at a distance, and refused to accept that any communication between subatomic particles could travel across space faster than light, as that would violate special relativity. But in principle, particles located at opposite ends of the universe can still be connected in this way. Entanglement was shown by the quantum pioneers to follow naturally from their equations, and experiments carried out in the 1970s and 80s confirmed that Einstein was wrong on this. We now know empirically that quantum particles really can have an instantaneous long-range connection. Our universe really is non-local. Today, many researchers working in fields such as quantum optics, quantum information theory, and even quantum gravity see a profound link between entanglement and the central problem of measurement in quantum mechanics. We must first acknowledge that a quantum system, say an atom, is in reality part of its surrounding world, and so treating it as isolated is not strictly correct. Instead, we must include in our calculations the influence of its surrounding environment. Such an open quantum system presents us with a much more complex problem to solve. But at the same time, it allows us to make some headway in understanding what it means to carry out a measurement on a quantum system, beyond what Niels Bohr referred to simply as an irreversible act of amplification, as the way to describe how quantum fuzziness is crystallized into reality when we carry out an observation. In fact, it is now clear that the environment surrounding a quantum system, such as an atom, can itself do the measuring. We don't require a conscious observer. We can think of the atom as becoming ever more entangled with its surroundings, such that its quantum nature leaks out into the environment, like heat dissipating from a warm body. This leaking out of the ephemeral quantum behavior is known as decoherence, and is part of an active area of study at the moment. The stronger the coupling between the quantum system and its environment, the more entangled it becomes, and the faster its quantum behavior disappears. Whether or not this process fully explains the measurement problem is still a matter of debate in some quarters. The thorny issue of how to solve the measurement problem and the boundary between the quantum world and the large classical world was first made famous by Erwin Schrödinger in the mid-1930s, when he came up with his famous thought experiment. Despite being one of the pioneers and fathers of the field, Schrödinger tried to highlight his own misgivings about the meaning of quantum mechanics. He asked, what would happen if we were to shut a cat in a box with a radioactive substance and a container with lethal poison? All the while the box is closed, we cannot say whether or not a particle has been emitted by the radioactive material, triggering a mechanism that releases the poison, killing the cat. All we can do is ascribe probabilities to the two likely outcomes. When we open the box, either a particle has been emitted and the cat is dead, or it hasn't and the cat is still alive. But according to the rules of quantum mechanics, and as long as the box is closed, the subatomic particle obeys the laws of the quantum world, and we must regard it as being in a quantum superposition of having been both emitted and not emitted at the same time. But now, within the closed box, the fate of the cat rests on this quantum event. Schrödinger argued that since the cat is itself made of atoms, albeit trillions of them, each a quantum entity, it too should exist in a quantum superposition, a state of being both dead and alive simultaneously. However, we only ever see one definite outcome when we open the box to look. That is, the cat is either dead or alive, never in this limbo state. A sensible way of resolving the issue is to assume that such quantum superpositions decohere away into their surroundings and therefore do not survive for long when we consider complex macroscopic objects like cats, which are never in two states at once, even before we open the box to check. In fact, while an isolated radioactive atom must be described as being in a superposition of having both decayed and not decayed until observed, it is surrounded by a complex environment of air, Geiger counter, and cat, all of which it rapidly becomes entangled with, so that the both-at-once option doesn't survive. So, has the problem been solved? And do the two options of dead or alive cat now reflect nothing more than our own ignorance of its fate until we open the box? If not, then we're still left with the mystery of what physical process is taking place when we open the box. What has happened to the option we don't see? Subscribers to the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics believe there is a neat and simple explanation for this. They argue that there are now two parallel realities in which each option is realized. What we find when we open the box reflects which reality we exist in. Other physicists, not prepared to accept the idea of a potentially infinite number of parallel realities, have come up with a range of alternative interpretations that still demand the existence of an objective reality in the absence of measurement, but all of which contain some strange aspects of reality hidden somewhere. For example, another way of interpreting quantum theory was first developed by the French physicist Louis de Broglie in the 1920s, and then improved several decades later by David Bohm. According to this interpretation, the quantum world is made up of particles guided by waves. Their properties are hidden from us and are called hidden variables. But describe a world without any of the fuzziness of the standard Copenhagen picture of reality. Rather than an electron itself exhibiting both wave-like or particle-like properties, depending on how we measure it, there are both waves and particles. But it is only the particles that we ever detect. A small but dedicated community of physicists around the world feel that this so-called de Broglie-Bohm theory has much to offer. But it remains a largely unexplored option among the corpus of quantum interpretations. Fascinating though it is, I will leave this discussion here, since many other books cover it in greater depth than I have time for. In any case, I leave the issue of the interpretation of quantum mechanics unresolved, since that is where we stand at the moment. Having focused thus far on the basic building blocks of matter and energy, the space-time in which they exist, and the quantum nature of reality underpinning it all, I've ignored some equally fundamental concepts in physics that emerge when large numbers of particles come together to make up complex systems. So let us leave the world of the very small behind for now and zoom out again to investigate what happens with the emergence of complexity, and explore such profound ideas as order, chaos, entropy, and the arrow of time.